Chapter 11, At the Crossroads. It is an ironic coincidence that the very year that marked the resolution of Machen's profound personal conflict was to usher in an era of grave tension in the life of the seminary. This was the tension that was ultimately to issue in the convulsive struggle that led to the radical reorganization of 1929. Machen himself had come to peace of mind and heart at the very time that issues in a controversy embracing the very life of the seminary were being drawn. Had the tensions of the years subsequent to his ordination been present beforehand to any considerable degree, it is most doubtful that he would have attained the courage to seek ordination. Certainly, he would not have been able to identify his life with that of the seminary as committed to a principle in theological education that won his enthusiastic allegiance. Because of the very struggle through which he had gone to win his certitude and commitment, however, he was prepared to be steadfast and unmovable in the broader conflict that was taking shape. Choosing Patton's successor. The year 1914 marks the dividing line in the history of the seminary, principally because of the election and installation of J. Ross Stevenson as president in that year. In singling out Dr. Stevenson in this manner, there is a danger of oversimplification which ought to be avoided, if at all possible. There were, no doubt, other significant factors that were to emerge later on. Moreover, one may observe prior to 1914 the very forces at work which were responsible for the election of Stevenson as the successor of Patton. He did not elect himself to this office. That was the responsibility of the board of directors, and they ultimately must be held accountable, for good or ill, for this decision. Nevertheless, the Stevenson administration was more than a product of earlier decisions and circumstances. Stevenson himself, seemingly more and more self-consciously, became active spokesman and agent for a point of view which was ultimately destined to revolutionize the seminary. There is another estimate of Stevenson's place in the struggle, which, however, in its own way, confirms the correctness of the position expressed above. His successor, Dr. John A. McKay, once said that in the conflict, the Princeton tradition was worthily incarnated in the person and attitude of President Stevenson. In this same article, which speaks of Stevenson's two master passions as foreign missions and the unity of the Church of Christ, special attention is centered upon his prominence in the modern ecumenical movement. He was a leading member of the Edinburgh Missionary Conference of 1910, which inaugurated the modern ecumenical movement. And it is recalled that the World Council of Churches was launched by the Archbishop of York in the living room of Springdale, the presidential residence at Princeton, with the full sympathy and support of Dr. Stevenson. It is fitting, Dr. McKay writes, that Dr. Stevenson should be the chief representative of American Christianity in the city of Utrecht, where the council became a reality in 1938. These statements are of special interest because of the light they cast upon Stevenson's dominating interests, and because in 1920 the issue of church union served to bring Machen into open conflict with him. That story still remains before us. Here one must reflect on the earlier aspects of the situation. Considering the fact that Stevenson was not a graduate of Princeton, it is at least somewhat remarkable that he came to be chosen president. How did this come about? Joseph Ross Stevenson was born in 1866, the son of a Presbyterian pastor in a small country community in western Pennsylvania. Concluding his arts course at Washington and Jefferson College in 1886, he entered McCormick Seminary in Chicago, where he graduated 3 years later. Following a year of study in Berlin, he was ordained and served as a pastor for 4 years in Sedalia, Missouri. Thereafter, he was professor of church history at McCormick for 8 years, resigning to become pastor of the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church as the successor of Dr. Purvis. Not long afterward, he was elected as a director of Princeton Seminary and continued in this capacity during the 7 years of his New York pastorate and the 5 that followed in Baltimore, where he had gone to serve the Brown Memorial Church. Thus, back of his service as president, commencing in 1914, there was a decade of active participation in the government of the seminary. During those years, the directors were confronted with pressing questions relating to the practical aspects of instruction. Following Paxton's retirement, the chair of homiletics remained vacant for 2 years, and the teaching in this field was conducted by special visiting lecturers or members of other departments. Dr. Erdman's inauguration as professor of practical theology in 1906 relieved the situation somewhat, but the perplexing problem of homiletics remained. As Machen's letters also reflect, one person after another was considered for the chair. A number of men, including Harris Kirk of Baltimore and Maitland Alexander of Pittsburgh, were elected but declined to serve. Dr. Loescher did serve from 1910 to 1913, but then returned to his first love, church history. It is lamentable that these difficulties occurred just at the time when there was something of a hue and cry for more practical instruction and a more practical emphasis in the instruction. The account of the student rebellion has recalled an acute manifestation of this tendency. And though the directors did not regard it as wise to support the student approach, they did undertake further study and ultimate revision of the curriculum so as to expand the place given to practical studies. Evidently, among the directors, there was a considerable body of sentiment sympathetic to the modification of the curriculum in this direction, and there is little doubt that Dr. Stevenson lent his support to this movement. The problems facing the directors were accentuated by the fact that Dr. Patton reached the age of retirement in 1913. At the time, it appears to have been widely held that this would not necessarily complicate the situation. If only the problem of the presidency and of homiletics would permit of a single solution. Machen himself indicates that for a time the man who was thought of as the solution to this double problem was Dr. William L. McEwen of Pittsburgh. Following Patton's retirement, at a meeting of the directors held in June 1913, a first step was taken which Machen felt offered new hope of a happy decision. That was the election of Dr. Loescher to the chair of church history. Moreover, he remarked in a letter of June 15th, if he does accept, then his present chair, that of homiletics, will be left vacant for a man who I hope will be elected president. A number of steps remain to be taken before the consummation can be reached, but at least no step has been taken in the opposite direction. What he had in mind appears more explicitly in a letter of July 11th written from Bozen in the Tyrol on the background of a letter from Armstrong. The letter from Army brings the satisfactory news that Loescher has consented to take the chair of church history instead of his present chair of homiletics. That is satisfactory news, for it leaves open the chair of homiletics for a president. But there will be anxious months before McEwen of Pittsburgh is elected. We can only hope. He is unquestionably the man for the place. A splendid man personally, a great power in the church at large, and with sound ideas with regard to scholarship. Were he elected, we should feel that there was opportunity for genuine progress at Princeton. But certain other men who have been mentioned for the place would be, if elected, a constant hindrance in the way of any enthusiastic work in the defense of the faith, and to me personally a sad blow. Of course, McEwen is not a candidate. Whether he would accept the chair if it were offered him is exceedingly doubtful, especially in view of the great importance of the work which he is now performing with signal success. You see, my hopes are based on ifs and ifs, but still they are hopes which are not impossible of fulfillment. Apparently, McEwen eliminated himself from consideration. At any rate, no one was elected to the presidency or the chair of homiletics at the fall meeting of the board, and the entire matter remained under discussion until June 1914. Evidently, a number of men were under consideration during that period, with Dr. Erdman mentioned most prominently for the post. Charles Rosenberry Erdman was born in 1866, a few months later than J. Ross Stevenson. Graduating from Princeton Seminary in 1891, he served as pastor of churches for 15 years, first in Overbrook and later in Germantown, both in outlying areas of Philadelphia. As has been noted, he began his service as professor of practical theology in Princeton in 1906, the very year that saw the commencement of Machen's service as instructor, and he concluded it 30 years later on his retirement. During this entire period and beyond it, he was prominently associated with the Board of Foreign Missions as a member 1906 through 42, and as president 1926 through 1941. He had been present at the World's Missionary Conference in Edinburgh in 1910. Thus, he shared certain special interests with J. Ross Stevenson, and the two men were intimate friends of long standing. Though Machen did not number Erdman among his intimate friends at Princeton, it appears that their relations were cordial until well beyond the present period. One of his first impressions of Erdman, as reported on September 23, 1906, was that he, as well as Armstrong, was the right stuff. And it was Erdman who, in 1914, recommended Machen to the editorial staff of the Board of Christian Education for the literary work which he undertook that year. Nevertheless, as Machen's letters home during the academic year 1913 through 14 frequently show, he was alarmed at the prospect that Erdman might be chosen president, and it is rather clear that in this regard his concern was shared by several other members of the faculty. His opposition to Erdman was clearly not personal, nor was it based on any lack of appreciation of his work in his own chair. But it centered on his judgment that he lacked the special qualities requisite in a president. As late as May 10, 1914, shortly after Machen had received his advancement to professional standing, Erdman was still being prominently mentioned for the office. For on that date, Machen indicated his objections at some length in a letter to his brother Arthur. He felt that Erdman possessed attractive personal qualities, but that he lacked the solid appreciation of genuine scholarship which would prove essential in one who would be a spokesman for the faculty in the meetings of the board and before the church and the world. Still more serious was a certain lack of discrimination with regard to issues which seems to close his eyes to real differences between himself and others. "I should rejoice in Erdman's good qualities," he wrote, "if he were not sinned against by being proposed for what he is not fitted for." The election of Stevenson. A few weeks later, shortly before the board was scheduled to convene on June 11, 1914, the complexion of affairs had taken a new turn. Suddenly, the name of J. Ross Stevenson came to the fore. On May 31st, Machen wrote his mother, "Ross Stevenson is rumored as the prominent presidential candidate. Erdman is said to be boosting him hard. Do you wonder that we become discouraged? Think of Ross Stevenson as president of this institution. I really believe Erdman would be better. Stevenson's notions about theological education are ruinous. They are especially bad with regard to New Testament work. And then, of course, you know what an extremely weak man Stevenson is." His mother replied on June 4th that she hoped his fears were groundless about the possibility of Ross Stevenson for president, and remarked what a tragic pity it was that Patton could not have held on to the office until some really suitable successor appeared. But the unexpected did develop, and Stevenson was elected president to the dismay of Machen and other faculty members. The opposition to Stevenson, no more than that to Erdman, was based on personal considerations. There was a fervor and frankness about him that Machen distinctly liked. And there is considerable evidence that Machen, however regrettable he found Stevenson's election, not only made the best of the resulting situation, but also positively sought to maintain cordial relations and to cooperate with the new administration. But his basic objections to Stevenson were essentially the same as to Erdman. And the dangers in the situation were aggravated by the fact that Stevenson, not being a Princeton man, could hardly be expected to possess and maintain a profound commitment and devotion to the historic Princeton position, especially in a time of crisis affecting the church as a whole. In a time when a drift away from the historic moorings was much in evidence, and Princeton was seeking to resist the current, the position of the faculty as a whole would naturally appear to be partisan, whereas Stevenson's outlook would likely be controlled by broader churchly and ecumenical perspectives. The election of Stevenson underscores a grave weakness in the government of the seminary in that day. The president of the seminary, or its acting president, sat in the meetings of the board in an advisory capacity. But it appears that the faculty itself had little or no direct voice in the determination of matters affecting the life of the institution in the most crucial manner. Evidently, there was, for example, no consultation with the faculty with regard to the acceptability of Stevenson as president. And thus the board, either because of an unfortunate conception of the exercise of its operations or because of lack of vision, was responsible for creating a situation in which the seeds of deep division within the faculty were sown. At the same meeting, another action was taken that was regarded as far more salutary. This was the election to the chair of homiletics of J. Ritchie Smith, who for many years had enjoyed a reputation as one of the most scholarly and attractive preachers in the church. Born in 1852 and graduating from the seminary in 1876, his work in the pastorate included a ministry of 22 years in Peekskill, New York, and one of 14 years in Harrisburg. During his latter ministry in 1903, he had published a substantial volume on The Teaching of the Gospel of John, which was respectfully, though not uncritically, reviewed by Dr. Warfield in the Princeton Review. He hailed it as an excellent study and as overcoming the evil that scientific exegesis and the practical exposition of Scripture fall commonly into different hands. He recognized, moreover, that although the ordinary run of sermons would profit greatly if a little more scientific exegesis lay at their foundation, the attitude of mind which belongs to the practical expounder of religion is essentially to the assimilation of the message of the word. We do not say merely in its fullness, but even in its general color and chief relations. Warfield, therefore, no less than the other members of the Princeton faculty, who were mainly concerned with scientific studies, was alive to the claims of the practical life of the church. And the delight at Dr. Smith's acceptance is not surprising. Though the new professor had already celebrated his 62nd birthday when he commenced his labor in the fall, he was not to lay down the responsibility until 15 years later, and he lived on until 1936. Machen had long been an intense admirer of Smith's preaching, and following his election had written to urge him to accept. The result was that the first word that reached the campus of his acceptance was received by Machen in a note dated June 27, 1914. In it, Dr. Smith stated that he was profoundly sensible alike of the honor and the opportunity, and I shall esteem it a high privilege to be associated with you and the other brethren whom I have long held in honor for their character and their works. A few days later, Machen wrote his mother that Dr. Smith's presence is going to be a fine thing for the seminary, and the personal association is going to be a delight to us all. Though, therefore, the directors made a gratifying decision with regard to homiletics, there was an incidental aspect of it that was less happy. There had been the hope that the man chosen for homiletics would also serve as president. But the choice of Stevenson, as well as Smith, meant that a third full professorship in the field of practical theology had been created. The task of administration was not considered a full-time job, and so Stevenson was given courses in the history of religion, missions, and homiletics. The total effect, therefore, was a further step downward in the scholarly emphasis of the seminary, since additions of courses in the practical department inevitably encroached upon the time allotted to theology, exegesis, and similar studies. Intra-faculty relations. At the beginning of the new academic year, the new additions to the staff were on hand. Dr. Stevenson was, of course, most conspicuous in his various capacities, and Machen acknowledged that his conference talk on prayer had deeply impressed him. The apparent genuineness of the man and the reality of his faith carried me along with him. On the other hand, his trepidation concerning the effects of his leadership remained. In his wisdom as a seminary head, I have no confidence, as you know, and the violent intrusions of some extra cinch courses into the seminary curriculum for the benefit of the president is most unfortunate. If we only could have had a somewhat broader man. Dr. Ritchie Smith has been conducting his classes during the past week. There is a man worth having. There is something really distinguished about even the most insignificant things that he does and says. Moreover, he is very friendly and cordial in his manner. The year that followed was, however, far from a peaceful one for the faculty. The directors had requested the faculty to give further consideration to the curriculum, and with the active support of the new president, this matter was pushed forward to a decision. A committee of the faculty prepared a report calling for certain further revisions, but it met with vigorous opposition. At one point, it failed of adoption as the result of a 6-6 tie. A week later, however, it was adopted by a narrow margin when Armstrong and Machen became reconciled to it, not as really a good thing, but on the ground that the scheme is as good as we can expect to get from the board. It is remarkable that at this point Machen deserted the leadership of Warfield and chose the way of moderation and compromise. This was an exceedingly hard decision to make for a number of reasons. He was greatly indebted to Warfield, who had been extremely kind to him in connection with problems that arose out of his difficulties with the Sunday school lessons, and in general had been generous in offering encouragement and advice. Moreover, Machen felt that Warfield was incomparably the biggest man at Princeton Seminary, indeed one of the very biggest men that I ever knew. He had come more and more to see the gigantic stature of Warfield, and he was in enthusiastic agreement with him as to the great things for which the seminary stood. Nevertheless, he came to feel that Warfield was unnecessarily uncompromising about some little things. Machen himself had put up a big fight to ensure the preservation of the necessary courses in Greek as a foundation for the work of the New Testament department, and had won his point. Taking stock of the attitude of the directors, he felt that it was wise to make certain sacrifices in the hope of conserving a great deal of good. Still, When Warfield ceased attendance at the faculty meetings in disgust at the course developments were taking, Machen could not but be sympathetic with him and sorry for him. At times, Machen shared something of Warfield's pessimism as to the future of the seminary. He even considered the possibility of departing, and might have done so if he had not been constrained by his devotion to Armstrong. Moreover, the psychology of an old man nearing the end of his career and that of a young man virtually at the beginning of his are likely to differ. Both might agree basically as to their analysis of the crisis confronting the seminary, but one might recognize that the battle had been lost and retire from the front ranks, whereas the other might possess the youthful determination to fight on to the end. These developments indicate that Machen, though a man of intense loyalties, did not slavishly follow any man, not even Warfield. Nor was he blind to the faults of those who he thought were dead right on the big issues. On the other hand, he was quick to recognize virtues in those who, as he became persuaded or as he feared, were taking a wrong stand. Machen's regard for Warfield did not diminish in the years that followed. This appears, for example, in his lengthy report to his mother of the death in 1915 of Mrs. Warfield, who for many years had been a bedridden invalid, and of the likely consequences for Dr. Warfield. I have faint recollections of her walking up and down in front of the house in the early years of my Princeton life, but even that diversion has long been denied her. I never spoke to her. Her trouble had been partly nervous, and she had seen hardly anyone except Dr. Warfield. But she remained, they say, until the end, a very brilliant woman. Dr. Warfield used to read to her during certain definite hours every day. For many, many years, he has never been away from her more than about 2 hours at a time. It has been some 10 years since he left Princeton, on the occasion of the experiment of taking her away in the summer. Despite the care of the thing, Dr. Warfield had done about as much work as 10 ordinary men. What the effect of her death upon him will be, I do not know. I think, however, that he will feel dreadfully lost without her. As Mrs. Armstrong said, he has only two interests in life, his work and Mrs. Warfield. And now that she is gone, there may be danger of his using himself up rather quickly. If so, I do not know who is to take his place. I am more and more impressed with him. He is certainly one of the very biggest men in the church, either in this country or in any other. Nor did he have occasion to change substantially his opinion of Dr. Stevenson, though it is noteworthy that for all of his sense of alarm, he did not become bitter. Writing on February 24, 1916, for example, he tells of a speech he heard Stevenson deliver at an alumni luncheon in Philadelphia. The speech, he wrote, was perhaps more discouraging than anything I have yet heard from him. He emphasized the intensely practical and advocating the choosing of professors from among the active pastors. My only hope is that, although he falls in with the current cant, he may not act so badly as he talks. But it will be an anxious time when the first of the major chairs falls vacant, for it may be filled with some pious liberal before we know it, or else with some intensely practical incompetent, such as other seminaries are getting. Fortunately, I like Dr. Stevenson much better than I did at first. Meanwhile, the situation in the Presbyterian Church was giving him increased concern, and he could not but wonder as to the future of the seminary, which was indissolubly bound up with its life. The 1915 General Assembly, the first to follow his ordination, was disappointing since nothing was done to relieve the intolerable situation in New York and Brooklyn presbyteries, where year after year, virtual unbelievers are received into the ministry. The church, he held, is still fundamentally evangelical, but sadly indifferent to the big questions. I fear that Stevenson, the moderator, rather shares the general attitude, though I have not altogether given him up. The following year, he is even more discouraged and reflects upon the situation at some length. Dreadful things seem to be going on at the General Assembly, the liberal candidate for moderator having been elected by a large majority. Of course, a good many brethren did not know how bad he is. He posed as a moderate conservative. But I fear the Union Seminary men, with their deceitful phrases and their contempt for the Christian faith, will go quite unmolested. I trust the Southern Church will keep quite separate. If things get much worse in the North, I should hardly like to continue making contributions to the Foreign Missions Fund, for example, of the Northern Church. Our Southern Board may continue to provide for the preaching of the gospel, and it will be well for those who believe in the gospel to have some faithful administrators of their funds. The mass of the church here is still conservative, but conservative in an ignorant, non-polemic, sweetness and light kind of way, which is just meat for the wolves. I do not mean to use harsh phrases in a harsh way, and my language must be understood to be biblical. But men like McGifford and William Adams Brown at Union Seminary are perfectly clear about the enormous gulf that separates their religion from Orthodox Protestantism, just about as clear about it as Dr. Warfield is. Why, then, do they try to deceive simple-minded people in the church? There is the real ground of my quarrel with them. As for their difficulties with the Christian faith, I have profound sympathy for them, but not with their contemptuous treatment of the conscientious men who believe that a creed solemnly subscribed to is more than a scrap of paper. Billy Sunday. Though the lines of future conflict were being drawn not only in the church, but also in the seminary, there remained a large measure of agreement. This is disclosed in the attitude taken by the faculty toward William A. Billy Sunday, who had become a sensationally successful evangelist after a career as a Major League Baseball player. And since we are to recall this incident in terms of Machen's own personal observations and reactions, a fascinating light is cast upon his own personal views. One learns first of his original impressions of the Sunday meetings in Philadelphia. Writing to his mother on January 24, 1915, he relates, "On Wednesday afternoon, I went to Philadelphia to get some typewritten copy and seized the opportunity of staying overnight and hearing Billy Sunday. Two meetings are held daily except Monday, and three on Sunday. The attendance at every meeting is about 20,000. Since I had not had time to get a ticket entitling me to a seat with the ministers, I was advised to go at about 5 o'clock in order to get a seat for the 7:30 meeting. At 5 o'clock, there were great crowds of people standing around the doors of the tabernacle. After standing about an hour in the rain, I learned from a policeman that the public was to be admitted only if, at 7:15, places were left over after certain delegations had been accommodated. Fortunately, the night was terrifically rainy, so that when I returned after 7, I was able to get into the building. I stood up at one of the back corners at such a vast distance from the platform that I could scarcely make out the features of the speaker. Most of the sermon, however, I could hear, though I missed the asides and was too much out of things to get any proper impression of the meeting. After the main meeting was over, I pushed my way up toward the center of the building and listened to the enormous choir, and afterwards to the discussion of methods before the hundreds of workers on the platform. This last part impressed me as much as anything else. Those people are in dead earnest. It is a great movement for the highest possible end. As I say, I had no proper opportunity to judge Billy Sunday himself, standing as I was in a sort of passageway and looking through a latticework. I felt so detached from the crowd as to be a spectator rather than a participant. The text of the sermon was Romans 12:1, and the treatment was thoroughly textual. I was impressed, as I have seldom been, with the permanent power of great words. In an environment so intensely modern, the words of Paul seem to be as up-to-date as they ever were. There was one good thing about the sermon, too. It was of a kind to engrave that great text upon the memory of all the listeners. At the time, it did not seem to me to be anything extraordinary, unobjectionable, but rather commonplace. But I was in no position to judge. And the big argument for Billy Sunday is the result of his preaching, "By their fruits ye shall know them." An audience of 20,000 people or more under the same roof is simply overpowering. I have seen such a crowd at least once before, at the Democratic Convention in Baltimore. But when you consider that in the Sunday meetings it is a matter of daily occurrence for 2 months, and indeed 2 or 3 times daily, the thought is even more overpowering. Think of an audience about 8 or 10 times as large as the seating capacity of our Baltimore Music Hall, assembling 2 or 3 times a day for 2 months. Machen's letter home a week later tells of attendance at another Billy Sunday meeting, in which he had the opportunity of making more satisfactory observations and judgments. I took another look at Billy Sunday last Friday night, utilizing a trip to the Board of Publications in this incidental way. This time, on Bobby's advice, I applied for a ticket and had a far better place to hear and see than in my first visit. I was very greatly impressed, far more so than on the other occasion. The text was 2 Samuel 12, verse 13. And David said unto Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." Then Nathan said unto David, "The Lord hath also put away thy sin." The sermon was old-fashioned evangelism of the most powerful and elemental kind. Much of it, I confess, left me cold. I took some of the touches of humor and did not think that they were mine. But the total impact of the sermon was great. At the climax, the preacher got up on his chair as if he had used a stepladder. Nobody could have thought the thing excessive, so dead in earnest were both speaker and audience. The climax was the boundlessness of God's mercy, and so truly had the sinfulness of sin been presented that everybody present with any heart at all ought to have felt mighty glad that God's mercy is boundless. In the last 5 or 10 minutes of that sermon, I got a new realization of the power of the gospel. The surprising thing is that the gospel, which is having this unprecedented effect in Philadelphia, is so aggressively and uncompromisingly old-fashioned. The magazines are expressing wonder at it. This wretched, immoral conception of the atonement, this absurd view of the authority of the Bible, and not a thing about the social gospel, which everybody knows is the really powerful thing today. Instead of it, just the old notion of the individual soul in the presence of God. Even the opponents have to admit that the thing is bringing results. Of course, the church is going to reap an evil harvest from all this error, from all this obscurantism, from all this realistic way of conceiving of heaven and hell. But meanwhile, it must be admitted that the results are partly, at least, mighty good. That is very much the tone of the article I read last night in The Independent. The Unitarians in Philadelphia are carrying on an active fight against the Billy Sunday movement. Bobby told me the other day that he had attended one of their meetings and was having the time of his life composing a sermon suggested by what he had heard. Every morning, on the page of the paper devoted to Billy Sunday, a Unitarian statement appears in opposition. "I like Billy Sunday for the enemies he has." Machen was indeed not uncritical of the evangelistic methods often employed, and he was both fearful and distressed with regard to a series of meetings being held at the First Presbyterian Church of Princeton early in February 1915 with a Dr. Mimhall as the evangelist. At an afternoon service, especially for young people, 82 young persons made profession of faith, and Dr. Beach reported that it had been a dignified meeting. Machen had decided to stay away, however. He did not want to seem to oppose the evangelistic movement, but he was afraid that, as superintendent of the Sunday school, a position from which he was not able to secure release until about a year later, he might be called upon to adopt methods which would be of doubtful wisdom in our school. He determined, however, as soon as he could get a list of the young people who professed conversion, to do what he could to follow up at least any that had been in his own class at one time or another. On Sunday night, he attended the regular evangelistic services, but was not much impressed. The sermon, he said, had upon me a rather depressing effect. The extreme literalism of Bible interpretation, coupled with vulgarity in the preacher and a certain false pretense of learning, sometimes makes it a little hard to accept even a message that in itself is true and good. His mother's response to this disclosed her characteristic agreement with his outlook. The professed conversion of 80 young people at once was impressive, but not the tinge of vulgarity and pedantry in a preacher of the gospel we believe in. I have forgotten, she added, which one of the great novelists it was who said, "There is nothing more trying than to hear our own cherished faith proclaimed by a pedant or a charlatan." Still, St. Paul was glad to have Christ preached, whether in pretense or in truth. And so we may rejoice also. Your uncle was thrilled by Billy Sunday's work. He wrote a long letter about it to Loy, which seems to have been very vivid, judging from Loy's joy in it. About this same time, the faculty of the seminary decided to invite Billy Sunday to speak in Princeton. And this precipitated a furor which comprehended the university and the town in its scope. The use of Alexander Hall at the university, the only large auditorium in town, was sought for this purpose, but President Hibben refused. Machen thought this was unjust, especially since the building was constantly open to most any Tom, Dick, and Harry of a lecturer, and liberal preachers were often invited to speak there. A general evangelistic meeting accordingly seemed impossible, since the address would have to be given in the much smaller auditorium of the First Church, and admission would have to be by ticket. But the faculty went ahead with its plan to hold the meeting on March 7th. Now the fires of resentment really blazed up as the opponents of Sunday became more outspoken and made it an occasion for attacking the seminary. On February 28th, Machen wrote, "Princeton is in a tremendous tempest over Billy Sunday. The action of the seminary in inviting him to speak in Princeton has been sadly misrepresented in the Daily Princetonian, the university newspaper, and the Princeton Press, the town paper. The Princetonian, particularly, is violently opposed to evangelical Christianity." In one editorial, it said, "The seminary authorities have seen fit to endorse, partially, the peculiar Sunday theology by inviting him to speak in the town under their auspices. His coming will serve one good purpose, has served it already, in fact. It will emphasize a fact that needs to be thoroughly advertised, that Princeton University and the Princeton Seminary are in no way connected with one another." Of course, the peculiar Sunday theology is really just a circumlocution for the old word Christianity. Dean West has published in the Princetonian a most unfair collection of horrible expressions from Billy Sunday, which collection West is charged with having cribbed from an anti-Christian article. Yet he pretends to be conservative, and no doubt is, in his view of the Bible, though he has always been a bitter opponent of such defenders of the Bible as are to be found at the seminary. To my mind, his article is immeasurably more vulgar than anything that Billy Sunday ever did at his worst. Hibben is very weak, tries to be decent and square, but is subject to evil influences. It makes me sad to read his contribution in the Princetonian to a series of articles on religion. There are Christian men in the university, but none of them is making much of a public confession of his faith. The active opposition of a militant materialist like Dr. Peyton, who in a Princetonian article takes the position that the emotional reaction from a revival will endanger the neutrality of the United States at the present crisis, is to me far less distressing than the total failure of men who call themselves Christians to see what Christianity is. As for the abuse of the seminary, I do not think that will do us any harm. What I regret more is the misrepresentation or concealment of the facts, of which newspapers are always guilty. The seminary has been entirely courteous throughout the whole matter. A tentative engagement was made with Mr. Sunday before the discussion at the university ever arose, and our last move was made only after a conference between Dr. Erdman and President Hibben, in which Hibben said he had absolutely no objection to what we are doing. The result of the whole thing is to make me more and more enthusiastic for the work that Billy Sunday is doing. His methods are as different as could possibly be imagined from ours, but we support him to a man simply because, in an age of general defection, he is preaching the gospel. We are not ashamed of his antiquated theology. It is nothing in the world but the message of the cross, long neglected, which is manifesting its old power. The great mass of the students at the university are very anxious to hear Billy Sunday. The seminary committee is simply being overwhelmed with requests for tickets. The situation is delicate. Despite Hibben's private assurances, we do not want to appear as though we were engaging the university students in something to which the authorities are opposed. Despite all the trouble, however, I am glad that the seminary, in this public way, is giving the right hand of fellowship to a man who is doing the Lord's work. There ought to be the closest kind of cooperation between real evangelism and the type of theology that we represent. Indeed, the two things are absolutely necessary to each other. And writing on March 7th, Machen said, "Tomorrow is the fateful day of Billy Sunday's coming to Princeton. Pretty nearly everybody in town wants to attend the services, one of which is to be at the inconvenient hour of 1:30 p.m. Of course, we had to turn down many applications for tickets, since even with extreme overcrowding, only about 1,000 people or so can get beneath the roof of the First Church. We had two long faculty meetings on Monday and Tuesday evenings. The former of these lasted from 8 until 12 o'clock, and absolutely nothing was done. The decision about the courteous thing to do towards the university was very difficult, but finally the difficulty was largely removed by a conference which President Stevenson and Dr. Ritchie Smith had with President Hibben, and by a note which Dr. Hibben then wrote to the former of these two gentlemen. Naturally, we could not call the meeting off or refuse university students admission without a very nasty situation, and the former alternative, of course, would have meant a serious betrayal of our principles. We have come in for a great deal of abuse. Dean West of the Graduate College, Woodrow Wilson's great enemy, being particularly ungentlemanly and unfair in his violent attacks upon the guest of the seminary. The town paper, the Princeton Press, as well as the Princetonian, is bitterly hostile. Despite all the criticisms, however, we are absolutely right, and for once absolutely and unanimously agreed. I do not think the criticism will do us harm. Billy Sunday's work is too splendid a thing to be stopped by 100 Dean Wests. As Bobby Robinson said when Army sent him a copy of West's attack, the fact remains that the city of Philadelphia has been deeply stirred. I was asked this week, on exceedingly short notice, to lead the seminary prayer meeting on Wednesday evening. The whole meeting lasts only about 25 minutes, but it offers rather a good opportunity of addressing the students in an informal way. I talked about Billy Sunday evangelism and Princeton theology and the relation between them, which I think is a very close relation. There is going to be an increased need for pastors who are really able to teach the people. In Philadelphia, for example, the ground has been broken in a wonderful way, and the question is whether the seed is to be planted. My trip to Pittsburgh last year gave me a vivid impression of the intellectual interests which are awakened, though of course not satisfied, by the Sunday campaigns. Having carried the fascinating story so far, one must confess to a certain feeling of frustration at not being able to report Machen's assessment of the actual meetings in Princeton. But the simple fact is that no such report is available. Either the customary weekly letter following the meeting was lost, or it was omitted because of a visit home. In the last analysis, however, the loss is not tragic, since the comments, of which note has been taken, disclose in a vivid and extensive way a remarkable episode in the life of Princeton and Machen's own personal estimate of evangelism of the Sunday type. Preaching and Preachers. In rounding out this chapter and taking account of developments before the entry of the United States into World War I, one must record certain evidences of Machen's own increasing activity beyond the call of duty at the seminary. And one or two other distinctly personal matters may not be passed over in silence. Coincident with the emergence of clarity of vision and purpose in the year 1913, Machen's attitude toward preaching underwent a decided change. In place of his earlier reluctant attitude, there was henceforth an eagerness to undertake invitations which came to him. He spoke now of his love of preaching, though he was not constantly assured that he made a success of it. Depending at first very largely upon a prepared manuscript, he developed more and more freedom as time went on. During the fall of 1913, on an occasion when he was preaching for his friend Bobby Robinson in Germantown, he used to practical advantage some advice given by his colleague Gimel McMillan. "When you forget the thread of your discourse, it is advisable to roar." At times he was disappointed that more opportunities did not open up, though the time was to come when he would be overwhelmed with invitations. After McMillan went to Wells College as president in 1913, he could count on preaching there and in the college town, Aurora, New York, year after year. And other interesting and challenging opportunities came to him with considerable frequency. One reason that he felt that he had to secure release from his activity as teacher and superintendent in the Sunday school at Princeton was that he did not enjoy the liberty of absenting himself with easy conscience so long as a successor could not be found. He could not but judge that he might perform a greater service to the church by accepting the invitations to preach which were coming to him in increasing numbers. Due to various circumstances, including in later years the delay of his ordination and his devotion to the Sunday school of the First Church, he enjoyed an exceptionally large number of opportunities of hearing other preachers. There was, first of all, the venerable Mr. Merkland, his pastor during his youth at Franklin Street, Baltimore. Occasionally, visiting preachers were heard, and his fragmentary diary for 1893 records under the date of July 9th the entry, "I went to hear Dr. Hoag today, and it was grand." Later in Northfield and Chicago and other summer vacation scenes, he heard many preachers of greater or lesser renown. At Princeton, variety was afforded not only by the services at the churches, but also at the seminary and university chapels. And a few comments upon the preaching that he heard have been presented in earlier pages. When opportunity came, however, he also liked to hear some of the celebrated preachers in New York City. A few of his early impressions of such preaching follow. On November 14, 1914, for example, he wrote, "Last Sunday, I had a very interesting time in New York. In the morning, I went to hear Dr. Parkhurst on Madison Square. The interior of the church building, like the outside, is characterized by a certain rich and magnificent simplicity, and the music seemed to me the finest church music that I have ever heard. The whole service was possessed of perfect unity. There was a splendid cadence about it which was never broken. The sermon was exceedingly stimulating. There was not a touch of Christianity in it, but its periphery bristled with sermons that a man who believes in the gospel might preach in supplement to it." Do not suppose, because of Dr. Parker's newspaper notoriety of a few years ago, that there is anything cheap or vulgar about him. On the contrary, his preaching is the perfection of art. He reminds me strikingly of Sparhawk Jones. He is evidently a powerful man. In the evening, I went to hear Henry Sloan Coffin on Madison Avenue, pursuing my policy of searching out a kind of preaching that I should not be likely to hear in the seminary chapel. The congregation impressed me. It filled the church to the doors. It was composed chiefly of young men and women. Evidently, there was a genuine congregational life. Evidently, too, the congregation was devoted to the preacher. The people fairly hung on his words. To me, I must say, he seemed rather commonplace, a contrast to the powerful man that I had heard in the morning, and more like the current type of liberalism of the day. He had a splendid idea for a sermon, but it was not well worked out. I am coming, by the way, to prefer sermons that are read. Ex tempore speaking, on the whole, is more likely to put me to sleep. It is apt to involve floundering. One thing in connection with the church provoked me. While a half-hour series of selections from the Stabat Mater was being rendered by the choir, I examined the hymn book, which was compiled by Dr. Coffin himself, with the cooperation of Ambrose Vernon, a wild fellow in New England. Though the preface said that the effort was to select only hymns that were specifically Christian, I was surprised to see the name of Felix Adler among the list of authors. Naturally enough, his hymn was anything but specifically Christian. What, in Coffin's mind, is Christianity? A letter of March 14, 1916, tells of an exceedingly varied diet that he had followed the preceding Sunday. Special interest attaches to these observations because Dr. Fosdick, like Dr. Coffin, was to figure prominently in the controversies in the Presbyterian Church of later years. Moreover, his criticism of a Roman Catholic service is noteworthy because he sometimes annoyed his friends by his tolerant attitude toward the Romish faith. In the morning, I went to hear Jowett and was most favorably impressed. A great deal is to be learned from Jowett about the art of sermonizing, especially the art of making a little go a long way. I do not say this by way of criticism, quite the reverse. I am coming more and more to see that if sermons are to be effective with the mass of the people, the points that must be made must be few, and variety in expression and illustration must be relied upon to maintain the interest. But what pleased me far more than the good homiletics of Jowett's work was the true evangelical ring in what he says. Jowett on Upper Fifth Avenue is like an oasis amid desert sands. In the afternoon, by way of contrast, I heard Harry Emerson Fosdick of Montclair, who is supplying Dr. Merle Smith's church on Madison Avenue. Fosdick has a great vogue, especially, I believe, among college men. And he is dreadful. Just the pitiful modern stuff about an undogmatic Christianity. I can listen to liberals like Dr. Parkhurst, powerful, earnest seekers after God, without becoming impatient. But this kind of stuff does make me somewhat tired, though I may do the man an injustice. Dr. Griffin of Hopkins, for example, used to be, if I remember right, deeply impressed with Fosdick. Certainly I am not. I should hate to think that Christianity were reduced to such insignificant dimensions. In the evening, I attended one of a series of doctrinal lectures given by the Roman Catholic Church for the explanation of Catholic doctrine to non-Catholics. The title of the lecture caught my eye when I saw it advertised, Creedless Christianity. Good, I thought. That's the thing I should like to see get a good hard knockout blow. I had been having creedless Christianity in the afternoon, fully enough of it to last me indefinitely. It would be refreshing to see it demolished. But I was on the whole somewhat disappointed. The lecture was held in the Church of the Paulist Fathers on the corner of 60th and Columbus Avenue. I have often noticed that church as I passed on the elevated, and had thought that the interior must be imposing because of the great height of the building. I was right. The vast proportions of the edifice, which seems to my untrained eye to represent a sort of mixture of Romanesque and Gothic architecture, with an immensely high nave and lower side aisles without a transept and the rich ornamentation, made me think I must be in some European church. The church is as big as 5 or 6 large Protestant churches put together, and was packed with an immense audience. I suppose 5,000 or so people must have been there. When I entered, I was asked whether I was Catholic or non-Catholic, and when I answered that I was non-Catholic, I was shown to an excellent seat. The lecture was by a certain Father Conway of the Paulist Order. It was, I really regret to say, a poor lecture. With a good deal of it, I could agree perfectly, for example, with its insistence upon the necessity of authority in religion. As long as the Protestant churches go on giving up that great idea, they will open themselves up to Roman Catholic attack. But on the whole, the lecture was confused and weak. If the Catholics would only make use of the rich heritage of their creed. But there is just the trouble. They don't seem to feel that the individual must see any importance in the incarnation and in the atonement. These things must be accepted simply because the church commands it. Any other doctrines would do just as well if submission were exhibited by acceptance of them. Nevertheless, I was intensely interested in the whole proceeding. Early lectures. During these years, one encounters also the beginnings of Machen's activity as a lecturer at educational institutions and Bible conferences, a type of service which later on was to make large demands of him. One of the earliest of these was undertaken in response to an invitation from a student society of the Seminary of the Christian Reformed Church in Grand Rapids, and developed on the background of the fact that the more energetic students of that institution often supplemented their regular courses with a year or more of graduate study at Princeton. Two lectures on The Authority of the Bible and The Virgin Birth were delivered on December 10 and 11, 1914. During the summer of 1915, he filled his first major Bible conference engagement at Winona, an event which was the forerunner of many that followed in later years there, at Grove City, Stony Brook, and other places. Among the speakers that year was Dr. A.T. Robertson of Louisville, whose books and letters had not filled Machen with enthusiasm, but who proved to be an entertaining lecturer and who improved greatly on personal acquaintance. Another speaker was Dr. Matt Hughes, a Methodist from California, who had the humor and the power of illustration and the personal magnetism which are necessary to get hold of a crowd, and yet what he said had also the rare advantage of being true. Such gifts Machen greatly admired, and felt that, in contrast, his own manner of public address was far from being an outstanding success. Still, he felt that the effort to be popular, especially as it expressed itself in some of the other speakers, was overdone, and he expressed his criticism rather picturesquely to his mother. "My criticism of Winona is that the rough house element is overdone. I do not object to a little of it, or even a good deal of it, but it does seem to me to be a pity that it should almost crowd everything else out." Practically every lecture, on whatever subject, was begun by the singing of some of the popular jingles, often accompanied by the blowing of enormous horns or other weird instruments of music. And the lectures themselves, if they were to be successful, had to be a good deal after the manner of stump speeches. Mind you, I do not despise that kind of thing. For myself, I confess that to save my life, I cannot make my sermons funny. But I do not despise the element of humor, even in speaking that deals with serious subjects. On the contrary, I believe that every really great speaker, like Dr. Patton, can play on the whole scale and not only on a part. There must be power of adaptation if results are to be obtained. I learned something about public speaking by contrasting the success of Matt Hughes, who really had big thoughts and yet got them into the mind of the rank and file, with my own failure. The only question is whether I can put what I learned into practice. Machen's success, as a matter of fact, was without doubt far greater than the above quotations might suggest. He himself goes on to say that after his last lecture, one gentleman said that I had paid me during the lecture the best compliment that has been paid to any speaker during the conference. There had been no applause whatever while I had been speaking. This may seem to be a rather backhanded compliment, but I am bold enough to take it altogether as such. The man who spoke to me meant it very earnestly as a compliment, and I was well pleased by it. There may be few, though a very few, people, even at Winona, who are content to consider a serious subject in a serious way. But there is confirmatory testimony of the favorable impression Machen had made. One minister, the Reverend W.C. Logan of Plymouth, Indiana, wrote Machen afterward that he had advised the Biblical World and the American Journal of Theology to secure him as a contributor, particularly after Logan had been told by their editors that it was difficult to get writers from the conservative side who had sufficient scholarship. And the secretary and general manager of the conference, Saul C. Dickey, wrote in appreciation that, "I heard good things of your lectures, and a number of ministers have told me that they receive more help from you than from other speakers." That he returned frequently to Winona, and later to other conferences, is perhaps the best evidence of his success. As the years went on, he increased in power of effective utterance, and yet he could never be anything but a straightforward, dignified, and earnest speaker who was deeply concerned that he should be understood, but never made use of cheap tricks in order to be popular. Invitations from Richmond. Far and away, the most significant recognition that Machen received during this period, not counting his advancement to professional standing at Princeton, came in the form of two invitations from Union Theological Seminary of Richmond. In view of the fact that Mr. and Mrs. Machen were active supporters of this seminary of the Southern Church and were friends of Dr. W. W. Moore, the president, there was a certain background of acquaintance and interest, which may well have commended consideration of the son of these good friends. Nevertheless, the character and the standing of Dr. Moore and the seminary at Richmond, and the nature of the invitations, were such that personal factors cannot have been of decisive weight. The first invitation took the form of an approach which Dr. Moore made about the end of March 1915 with the hope that Machen might be willing to leave Princeton for Richmond to become professor of New Testament. The chair had recently become vacant through the sudden death of Dr. English, and what Dr. Moore wished, as he wrote later to Mrs. Machen, was, if possible, an assurance from him that he was in a position to consider it before a formal election should be made by the board. At the same time, he indicated that, so far as he was concerned, the matter had not been a private or confidential one. The matter, he wrote, was fully known to our large and widely scattered board of trustees, to our faculty, and to many in our seminary community. There is no doubt that he would have been unanimously elected if he could have seen his way to let the board proceed. Machen had, however, pledged his mother to secrecy because he felt that his position in his own church in Baltimore would be distressing when, as he felt that he would probably do, he declined the offer. On the other hand, he felt compelled to give the invitation serious consideration. A call to serve his ancestral church made a strong appeal to him. And, as we have observed, there were dark clouds on the horizon at Princeton that made him uneasy about the future there. He wrote at once that he was bound to take the approach made by Dr. Moore under serious advisement, but within a week sent a definite statement of declination. He was virtually on the eve of his installation at Princeton, and he had developed a profound sense of commitment to Princeton and to Dr. Armstrong. But the main reason he gave for declining concerned the apologetic character of his work. Writing to his father on April 9, 1915, he said, "It would be impossible in a brief letter to detail my reasons for sticking to Princeton, as I set them forth in my letter to Dr. Moore. Before long I hope to see you, perhaps in Baltimore, certainly in Princeton, and shall then seize the opportunity of talking the thing over. My fundamental reason for my decision, aside from the quite exceptional opportunities and facilities which Princeton offers me, was that Richmond hardly needs at present that apologetic treatment of the problems of the New Testament, which for the past 12 years has been my chief concern. Of course, I feel most deeply distressed at rejecting any proposal, even of a merely preliminary and personal and private character like Dr. Moore's, which comes to me from the Southern Church." This summary is in agreement with Dr. Moore's report to Mrs. Machen, but he also tells her that her son's letters on the subject were perfect, and I hold him in higher respect and admiration now than I did before, though it was a sharp disappointment to me that we could not secure him, and that I could not have the pleasure of association with him in our great work here. Though the Richmond Seminary could not have Machen as a member of its staff, it was determined to gain the advantage of his instruction and to honor him by inviting him to give a course of lectures in the James Sprunt series, which had been established in 1911. The purpose of the richly endowed lectureship was to enable the institution to secure from time to time the services of distinguished ministers and authoritative scholars outside the regular faculty as special lecturers on the subjects concerned with various departments of Christian thought and Christian work. Machen informed his mother on October 24, 1915, of the invitation to deliver the lecture in 1920 or 1921. Machen welcomed the opportunity, partly because it would stimulate him to get out at least one book in the intervening time, which then seemed far away. An immense amount of painstaking labor was required, however, before he was prepared early in the year 1921 to deliver the lectures, and somewhat later that year to publish his brilliant book, The Origin of Paul's Religion. Though he did not publish very much for some time after the spring of 1915, he was busily engaged in writing up a new course in apostolic history, which he gave for a time beginning in the fall. He was also working with a view to the preparation of the Sprunt lectures. One gets a somewhat new impression of his method of composition, as well as his continued love of walking, from a letter written from the Vanderbilt Hotel in New York on June 9, 1915. For me, these are days of rest and refreshment in my favorite spot. On Monday and Tuesday afternoons, I saw Baltimore play Brooklyn in the Federal League. After the Tuesday game, I footed it all the way back to the Vanderbilt, first a mile or so through Brooklyn, then a most delightful walk across the new Manhattan Bridge with a most astounding view of the Brooklyn Bridge and Lower Manhattan in the evening light, then up through the Bowery and Fourth Avenue. The total distance was about 6 miles, and the scenery was certainly varied. Including incidental walking in the morning, I suppose I made about 10 miles that day. This afternoon, I took the train to Tarrytown, my previous pedestrian farthest north on the Hudson, and from there took a most delightful 7 or 8 mile walk to Ossining, whence home by train. This gives me a pedestrian knowledge of Broadway all the way from the Battery to Ossining, about 35 miles from there. The glimpses out through the trees and over magnificent lawns on today's walk were lovely, though most of the way the road runs away from the river. If there is a more beautiful small town than Tarrytown, New York, I don't believe I happen to remember it just now. On Monday night, I went to the Pirates of Penzance. This is the bulliest opera ever put on stage except Iolanthe. Some of the rest of Gilbert and Sullivan's I do not like quite so much, though the poorest of theirs is better than the best of anybody else's. Dear me, how I linger in this restful, health-giving, and soul-restoring spot. But I must go back to Princeton tomorrow or next day on Sunday school business. In the mornings, I have been doing some writing on my new course, and in the afternoons, as I walk, I try to outline what I shall say. I also have to get up a sermon for a week from Sunday. Fortunately, the outline of it took shape in my mind during one of my walks, but it is very poor. The Passing of Mr. Machen. Thus there were some recreation and relaxation in the midst of severe trials and toil. But the year 1915 was to bring one unspeakably sad development. That was the disruption of the family circle by the death of Machen's father on December 19th. Though he lived 5 months beyond the 88th anniversary of his birth, he remained until the end in full possession of his extraordinary mental vigor and with little abatement of his physical powers. He had become somewhat deaf, and a few days before his death felt slightly indisposed. But on the day before his passing, Mrs. Machen had closed her letter with the words, "I am better, your father well." He walked to church as usual on Sunday morning, listened with close attention to a sermon by Dr. Kirk on John 1:14, walked home, but sank into a chair at the door and passed away almost immediately. As his son Arthur recalled in his biographical sketch, "Here, quietly, without a word or groan, surrounded by his family, and with the great words of the text yet ringing in his ears, his strong, self-reliant spirit, securely trusting in his Savior, left his outworn body." Sad, indeed, and broken, was the household which remained. The vacant place in every heart was such as no one else could fill, and each survivor knew that throughout life the sorrow, changing indeed in character with the passage of time, would yet always be present. Nevertheless, in the midst of grief, none, not even the one upon whom the blow fell with most annihilating force, failed to rejoice in the memories and associations over which, even in this world, death has no power. In estimating the character and achievements of Arthur Webster Machen, we had occasion in the first chapter to take note of certain resolutions that were adopted at the time of his death, and limits of space do not permit any considerable notice of the numerous letters of sympathy which followed. but extracts from two or three letters from persons who knew him intimately for many years may serve to round out our picture of this man of rare Christian character and culture. Dr. Patton's long letter of sympathy to Machen, written from Bermuda on January 6, 1916, contains the following words. How much you have to be thankful for in the loving memory of one who in his home was such a model of what we love to see in the relations of domestic life. I count it one of the rare privileges of my life to have known Mr. Machen and to be counted among his friends. I read with great interest the extracts from the Baltimore papers which you sent me, and as I read, I felt that the beauty and ripeness, the patience and contented enjoyment of old age, was never more beautifully illustrated than in your dear father's life. And Dr. Gildersleeve wrote the following charming note to Mrs. Machen. December 21st, 1915. Dear Mrs. Machen, my own sense of loss gives me some right to share in the bereavement that has come to you and yours. My grief at the death of Mr. Machen is deeper than some of his intimates might suppose. We were fellow travelers over a stretch of time that few are destined to reach, and that of itself made for companionship. What gaps in the ranks of our friends and acquaintances since the death of Richard Gittings, his partner and my classmate, who first brought us together. We often met on our several ways, going home, going to work, and I shall miss his pleasant greeting, his half-humorous smile, for in this busy Baltimore, he was one of the few that understood my like of work. For my work was his pastime, and his smile was that of one who shared a weakness, for nowadays a love for the ancient classics is a weakness. A beautiful life, and what a fair end! His mind filled with the image of our elder brother evoked by text and sermon, and then the translation to an unseen that had no terrors for him. It is such an end that an old man like myself might pray for day and night. I dare not offer words of comfort to one who is so familiar with the higher ranges of thought and knows so well the higher sources of consolation. I can bring you only this expression of human sympathy in which my wife begs to join. Yours sincerely, Basil L. Gildersleeve. And Miss Claire de Graffenried, the intimate friend of Mrs. Machen from Macon days and of the family from the beginnings of its life in Baltimore, wrote to Machen on December 30th. As the days go by, the great bereavement of Mr. Machen's leaving us weighs more and more upon me, the first excitement having passed. I do not know how any of us is to face life without him. So much a part of us he has always been. Friend, counselor, model to look up to, companion rarely gifted to enjoy. Where else is there a man of such character and tastes? Except his own sons, I know few men now who combine the highest standards of living with high culture. Specialists are having their day, therefore your father's life and character shine more brightly and will continue to be a blessed and cherished memory. You, dear Gresham, have a bereavement and a mission now. The mission to be like him and to comfort your mother. She leans on you as no other person in some ways. She delights in you without an arrière pensée, except for your uncertain health of late. I trust this is reestablished and that you are able to go on with the work you love to the honor of us all, and serving the higher aims you live for. That Machen was to comfort his mother in word and deed for the rest of her years is one of the remarkable features of the story of his life. Always strongly devoted to her, his affection and concern for her seem now to have been intensified. He could not take the place of his father, but more than anyone else, he stepped into the breach. And there was perhaps never a more tender and dutiful son. particularly during the long summer holidays, when it was Mrs. Machen's continued custom to stay at Seal Harbor, he spent as much time with her as his duties allowed. He often declined attractive engagements at home and abroad that would have interfered with his fulfillment of what he considered his obligation to her. Unquestionably, the inner developments, as well as the outer course of his life, was influenced by his mother. Nevertheless, however rare and strong the love between them, it never became an enervating force so far as his commitment to the demands of Christian discipleship was concerned. It was the love, not of weak and selfish sentimentalists, but of two powerful personalities whose exceptional strength of character was energized by their wholehearted acknowledgement of the exclusive rights of him whom they worshipped as God and Savior. Although his father did not live to share the years of struggle that lay ahead, one may rejoice in the providence of God, which permitted him to live to see the day when his son was firmly established in his Christian faith, ordained to the gospel ministry, and installed as a professor in a distinguished theological seminary. Considering that he was 54 years old when this son was born, and that more than a decade was to elapse after his son entered the seminary before these happy events were to take place, it is truly remarkable that he lived to see that consummation. He had never lost faith in the ultimate issue, and it was now as if, having lived to see that day, he could be dismissed in peace.